is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. If you're fortunate enough to have your holidays coincide with getting some time off work or school to rest up and recharge for the new year, that can present the opportunity to travel. And if you've given any thought to packing your bags and leaving home for a while, we've got some holiday travel tips you won't want to miss. Joining me in this recorded conversation is travel host Rick Steves to share some advice for your next adventure. Welcome back to the program, Rick. It's wonderful to have you here.
Thank you, Lucy. Nice to be here.
I want to start with this whole idea of holiday travel. Is this a good time of year to travel as far as prices and crowds and all those things we take into consideration?
Well, I should be honest. I just do Europe, so that's my thing. That's my beat. I've spent 100 days in Europe ever since I was a kid, so that's a long time. And I find I never run out of things to do in Europe. It's so exciting for me. And it's just a joy to go back and realize, oh, I never considered this, oh, I never considered that. And there's new avenues, new adventures, new eurekas. And holiday travel to me is people have vacation time, so they want to do something fun. It's not really because it's a holiday. It's because I want to get out and see the world.
Right.
And I love traveling off season. And when you're thinking about Christmas holidays and so on, because it's less crowded, it's more real, and it's not so hot. Mm-hmm. And the big change in Europe lately is crowds and heat. And a lot of people are traveling off season because it's more comfortable. Mm-hmm. Whether it's cheaper or not, I don't know. I don't really travel. People want to ask me, what's the best destination? What's happening? Where's my dollar going to stretch the farthest? Well, if I told you your dollar's going to stretch the farthest in Portugal, but you're dreaming about Ireland, what's the best value for you? It's Ireland.
Right.
You know? So go where you want to go and travel smartly. In the winter, in holiday time, yeah, go to Germany, check out the Christmas markets. But I don't go to Germany for the Christmas markets. I go to Germany for Germany. And if I'm there in December, hey, it's fun because there are the Christmas markets.
Sure. Are there favorite destinations you have when it comes to winter travel? I mean, you're such an experienced traveler. If people are thinking, I really want that holiday experience, are there favorite places?
I like to travel like a cultural chameleon. Wherever I go, I become a temporary local person. And, you know, in Paris, they have a thing called window licking. I forget the French word, but it's literally window licking.
Probably sounds prettier than that.
Yeah. But window licking is enjoying all the decorated windows like we do here in the United States and shopping.
Oh.
They even have little stepping stools for the little kids to step up and get a closer look at the displays in the window. But Paris is a city of style and class and elegance. And you see that in the grand department stores and in the windows and in the decorations in the parks and so on. So, you know, I just think that's a delightful thing. I guess I would say the main difference between winter travel and summer travel is in the winter, the small towns and the beach resorts and so on, they just shut down.
Mm-hmm.
And the cities are just thriving. So I would be more urban in the winter and more villages and beaches and so on in the summer.
Mm-hmm.
Remember when you're doing anything in the mountains, like the Alps, there's two seasons. There's the hiking season, and there is the skiing season. And then there's a dead time between them where you don't even want to go because the hotels and restaurants don't want to see you. They're shutting down. They're renovating. They're getting ready for the next high season.
That makes sense. You mentioned Christmas markets in Germany. I think a lot of us have heard about how magical those can be. If you're planning a trip to one of those Christmas markets, if that's your destination, and you just want to splurge, you know you're going to buy a lot of stuff to bring home either for yourself or for loved ones or friends, what's your advice for the best way to get stuff home? Does it depend on what you want to buy, whether you should ship or have extra room in a bag?
Well, I always pack light. I've never checked a bag in my memory. Going over. But checking a bag going home with your souvenirs is great, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I bring a little, I call it a Don't Tell Rick bag. We've designed this bag, which is your souvenirs bag. And I go over with my carry-on bag, and 9 by 22 by 14 inches is as much as I let myself take. We take 30,000 people on my Rick Steves bus tours every year on 1,000 different bus tours around Europe, and nobody is allowed to check any bags to start the trip. So it's doable. I always say, there's two kinds of travelers, those who pack light and those who wished they packed light. And people have excuses, you know, but I'm this, but I'm that, but what about this? And I'm adamant about this. Man, woman, rich, poor, north, south, winter, summer, 2 weeks, 2 months, I don't care. you need to be mobile. So start your trip that way. If you're going in the winter, you need to dress like you're almost skiing because you spend a lot of time outdoors and it's cold. It's bitter cold in a lot of cities. But then when you do buy your souvenirs, and assuming you're going to Europe in holiday time to do some shopping, have that extra bag and you check that bag, but you still carry on the rest of your gear. And unless you're buying big stuff, you should be just fine. If you're buying big stuff or breakable stuff or things that you want to ship separately, always negotiate that with the merchant because they can take care of the duty and they can wrap it properly and they can ship it home. It just makes more sense than trying to do it on your own.
That makes sense. Yeah, they know what they're doing. And we mentioned Germany for these Christmas markets. Are there other places that have terrific Christmas markets? If somebody's all about Christmas markets, where do you recommend?
Well, European tourism is a big deal. It's the number one source of revenue for a lot of these, foreign revenue for a lot of these countries. It's a huge employer. And everybody's trying to figure out clever ways to stretch their season. So there's all sorts of, frankly, commercial gimmicks to get you to go in the winter. And these relate to holiday time. So they put on lots of, you know, artisan markets and so on. And they're not unique to Germany. They seem to kind of be Germanic, but you can find them in other countries as well. But the best, the most classic, you know, the ones that feel just like a fairy tale, are in Germany, Switzerland, and Austria, I would say. And the most famous is in Nuremberg, and it's amazing. Nuremberg is just a beautiful Christmas market. I love the Christmas market in Salzburg, but you'll find Christmas markets all over Europe. Do remember when we're thinking about holiday travel that in the United States, Christmas is, you know, a couple of days out of the year. In Europe, it's a 6-week series of holy days and special times, holy day, holiday. And it starts the end of November or early December. And there's, you know, Santa Lucia Day, St. Nicholas Day, the Advent, there's all sorts of things. And then there's even holy days after Christmas all the way up to January 6th, which I believe is Epiphany. Mm-hmm. And that's the day the wise men brought the presents to baby Jesus. And that's a big day. So, and for a lot of societies, New Year's Eve is a big day also. So you've got a lot going on during that period from the beginning of December until the first week in January. And you should just know, do your studying ahead of time. If you go to Italy in that first week of the new year, it's all about Presepe. Presepe are manger scenes. And I notice even here in Cincinnati, you've got live manger scenes and so on. And every parish really puts a lot of energy into the fancy manger scene that's in their church. And it's a beautiful time when it's like open house from church to church. And you wander around, you go into the churches, and you ooh and ah about these beautiful manger scenes. The biggest one is right on the main square in the Vatican, the Piazza San Pedro. And they've got a literal house that is the manger and a towering Christmas tree. And it's sort of the capper of all of this wonderful time when the community's out, bundled up, enjoying the squares. And it's a delightful time to be there.
Wow. What if people aren't into Christmas markets, but they're interested in kind of Christmas traditions and where some of these traditions started, some of the history of Christmas in Europe, what are places they can go that aren't just all about shopping?
Well, the first place they should go is to my website, ricksteves.com, and go into the TV section. Every TV show I've ever made is there for free. It's just a click away. 150 TV shows that we've enjoyed on public broadcasting over the last 30 years. And go to the specials section, and there's a one-hour special that I made about European Christmas. And it takes you to 7 different countries, and we get into the sacred and traditional and non-commercial and beautiful dimensions of Christmas. And it's just a delightful hour. And again, you can just watch it. It's free, no ads, just bam, you've got it. And then you can see the wonderful, fascinating origins of all these Christmas traditions and how so many of them even predate Christianity. I mean, these were pagan festivals. It's the midwinter festival, call it what you like, but here's a new religion. You're going to be a Christian now, and we're going to take the festival of Saturn, and we're going to tune it into the day Jesus was born, and you're all going to be thankful that this is a long, dark winter, but there's going to be life coming on again. These kind of origins, when you think, I really like in my travels not to be ethnocentric, you know, not to measure everything back to the United States, not to think the world's a pyramid with us on top and everybody else trying to figure it out. because that's not right. And it is a bad, ethnocentric, ugly American sort of attitude when you're on the road. But I also, while I don't want to be ethnocentric, I don't want to be chronocentric. Chronocentric is looking at things through a 2023 lens. Mm. It's a real thing these days. You know, politically correct people want to judge everything by our 2023 sensibilities. I'm all for how we're striving to be equitable and fair and all this kind of great stuff. But I don't like to judge past times on how evolved we are that way. So it just makes no sense to me. Mm-hmm. I like to try to understand my sightseeing and the cultural learning I'm doing through a local context and try to understand what it was like back then. What was the mindset 500 years ago before they had public radio, you know, before they had moving images, before they had science, back when the Roman Catholic Church controlled the sacred texts and they're only available in Latin. And they had to be translated to you and interpreted and spoon-fed to you by some priest. What were the opportunities for corruption and taking advantage of people who were uneducated way back then? Mm. Try to understand it. And then what was the big deal when they finally translated the Bible into a language people could read? And somebody questioned whether you have to go to Rome to get to heaven. And there was a big war. And that was 500 years ago. Well, if you're looking at a church from pre-Reformation times, try to see it through pre-Reformation eyes. It's just a philosophy to your sightseeing. If you're looking at a handwritten manuscript, imagine how precious that was when information was power. There was no Google. There was no printing. Most people couldn't read. And you've got these handwritten texts. And then imagine what happened when Gutenberg made it possible to print this stuff up cheaply. Mm-hmm. And, you know, all of a sudden people were literate and all of a sudden things were kind of going viral 500 years ago.
Yeah.
That's, to me, that really opens up your sightseeing and it frees you to get turned on and blown away by the culture and the things you're learning about. So as we travel and we hit these festivals, understand. There was a time when boys and girls couldn't get together without the parents watching. And they would get together and they would show off at these festivals and they would do all these folk dances. Folk dancing is just medieval flirting that is okay for the parents.
We are going to continue our conversation in just a moment. And later in the program, we'll talk about holiday baking with some local experts. This is Cincinnati Edition. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Lucy May. We're continuing our recorded conversation with travel host Rick Steves, who's here to share his holiday travel tips. Rick, we've talked a lot about holiday travel. There are certainly people who are thinking about winter travel aside from the holidays. They maybe got holiday plans at home and they want to go abroad afterwards. If people are just getting started, how important is planning for a trip? How far ahead do you need to plan? What are the things you make sure to lock down first?
You know, that's interesting you asked me that question because I'm just giving talks tonight and last night in Dayton and Cincinnati for public television. And I'm talking about the importance of packing or planning. Packing light, yes, but the importance of planning. And I just think, for one thing, it extends the joy of your trip because you're getting into that frame of mind ahead of time. And the more context and understanding and skills you bring to your travels, the more you'll enjoy. Well, I like to think that we want people to enjoy maximum travel thrills for every mile, minute, and dollar on their vacation. And we Americans have the shortest vacations in the rich world. So we need to use our time smartly. We're always trying to see too much. And make a smart itinerary. And one of the results of the whole pandemic era is that great sites had to control the crowds by monitoring how many people they would let in. So you had to get a timed entry. And every 15 minutes, they'd let in another 50 people or whatever. And now they don't need to do that anymore, but they want to do it because they like to not have that chaos outside their door. So you no longer have a 200-yard long line in front of Anne Frank's house. And you no longer have a commotion of crowds in front of Leonardo's Last Supper in Milano. You've got every 30 minutes, 50 people showing up because they made a reservation and they've got that QR code on their phone and they are let in. It's sort of sanity. It's quite nice from the museum's point of view. We have to remember these days, so many of us travelers have this herd mentality. We always go to the same places at the same time and marvel at how crowded it is. When you could The rest of Europe is not crowded with tourism. So that's a very important thing is to remember in your planning. A new dimension of planning is knowing what you need reservations for in advance and then going online and making them. It's a different sensibility. Another thing is in Europe, they pay their workers so well that it's quite expensive to have good service. And they're trying to automate everything. So if you insist on giving hard cash to a human being to buy that ticket at a box office, they might have that available, but it's going to really be frustrating and they're not going to give you much respect because you should be doing it with your credit card online. Mm. That's what they're pushing everybody into. And for me, it's an adjustment because I like hard cash and giving it straight to somebody. But I'm getting good at that now. It's just, you know, paying on advance with my credit card and getting the QR code and then just showing up at the right time. So when I'm updating my guidebooks and every city, it seems, should have a sidebar on the front page that says what you got to have reserved in advance. And this is really important if you're sightseeing in Europe because, as I said, everybody likes to go to the same places. And they and the critical places that you want to see require reservation. If you go to the box office, a lot of times it just says, we don't have a box office anymore. There's a taped sign on the window. Go home, go online and book it. So what I want to do with my Rick Steves guidebooks is say, if you're going to Amsterdam and are the typical traveler and you want to see Anne Frank's house, you want to see Van Gogh, and you want to see the Rembrandts at the Rijksmuseum, and you want to go to a trendy, very cool and exciting restaurant for dinner, those are the four things you need to book in advance. And that also means everything else you can just do on the fly. But people need to know that. If you go to Rome intending to see the Sistine Chapel or the Colosseum, without a reservation, you're not going to see it. You're going to be very frustrated. And if you're desperate, you will pay somebody an exorbitant price who buys those tickets up in spec and will take advantage of you. But the smart travelers book in advance. I like to say there's two IQs of European travelers, those who wait in lines and those who don't wait in lines. And if you're waiting in line, you're probably screwing up.
Yeah. What about those off the beaten path places? You know, you talk about how you discover new things every time you go. You have these eureka moments. What are some places if people are planning and maybe they've already been and they've been to the Louvre, they've been to these museums, they've seen the masterpieces, they've seen the beautiful cathedrals and churches. Yeah. They're lucky enough to have those experiences under their belt. Right. What are some of those other places where you can visit a place that's off the beaten path, live like a local, and really experience Europe that way?
Well, that's the magic right there. You just hit it on the nail. I mean, I started my whole teaching writing a book called Europe Through the Back Door. And the idea was going through the back doors and finding these places that are not promoted, that places, magical little places that have no promotional budgets, places that don't live and die on the tourist dollar. And you said, well, what if you've seen all the famous things? Well, then the fun starts. Okay, you've checked off all those things on your bucket list. Now you can travel and just be there. What I like to think is you could be a, quote, well-traveled American when it comes to Europe, but you've always seen the big famous places. What about the second tier sites? And they're not second quality. They're just not as trendy. Every country has its, you know, everybody goes to Edinburgh. What about Glasgow? Everybody goes to Lisbon. What about Porto? Everybody goes to Paris. What about Lyon or Marseille? These are great cities. I call them second cities. And the cool thing about second cities is they're less expensive. They're more edgy. A lot of them are industrial sort of rust belt places that are now leaping into the fore with energy and with creativity and wonderful little mom and pops and wonderful galleries and wonderful street art. You go to these second cities and you take a street art tour. You take a food tour. You know, you enjoy the energy of a town that is not focused on tourism. It's really quite refreshing after standing in long lines to see Big Ben and the Eiffel Tower.
Sure. And how do you figure out where to stay, especially in those kind of second cities? How do you decide hotel or bed and breakfast, or maybe rent some out, somebody's apartment or flat? Mm-hmm. How do you make those decisions?
Well, if you're going to a place where you have a guidebook, that's what you have a guidebook for. A guidebook is a $20 tool for a $3,000 experience. And this is what I do. I've written 50 guidebooks, and I have a staff of 100 people, and we spend a lot of energy visiting sites in person and updating them. I spend 100 days a year in Europe. A third of that time is with working on my tours. A third of that time is filming TV for public television. And a third of that time is me alone with local guides updating my guidebooks. And as far as accommodations go, you got to decide, what kind of accommodations do you want? Do you have miles, and do you want to stay in some international chain outside of town or at the airport because it's free with your incentives? And it's got elevators and all the modern stuff, and you can tune into your favorite TV channel. Or do you want to stay in a characteristic town in the old center, which might not have an elevator, and where you might not be able to drive to, and it might not take your incentives and so on. So you got to decide that. I like a small family-run hotel in a great location. That's what I really like. Bed and breakfast used to be great, but now they're pretty much Airbnb and absentee managed. My traditional dream of a bed and breakfast is being part of a family, and you know, the lady of the house serves you a nice breakfast, and they invite you to sit down and have tea and cookies and watch the soccer game that evening, and you're staying in their house, and it's kind of a boost to their meager family budget. But now it's mostly people who have desirable location, and they realize I can move into the suburbs where no tourists want to go and rent out my apartment and really make a living doing that. And you have a little corner depot where that's the conciergerie for all of these B&Bs, and it's automated now, and it's just business, and it's you don't meet anybody, but it's a good value. But we got to remember there's an ethical issue when you stay in these short-term rentals of you're booting out the local people. They have to live out in the concrete suburbs. And the irony is, what made that old traditional neighborhood charming was the people who lived there and the businesses they kept alive with their patronage. Now they're gone. Those businesses cannot survive anymore, and they're replaced by businesses that cater to the tourists. So the market on the Ramblas in Barcelona no longer caters to local people with their shopping baskets. It's catering to tourists with, you know, slushies and exotic fruit on skewers and potpourri. It's not the Ramblas anymore. So we have to kind of make that all balanced together. But there's plenty of options for good accommodations in Europe.
Yeah. One final question for you. What if you're a person who's always felt like you could never travel abroad because of maybe the cost or the time? You mentioned the small amounts of vacation time that we have in this country. How do you get it in your sights? How do you make it happen if you really aspire to travel abroad, either by yourself or with your family, and it just seems out of reach?
Most people who don't think they can afford to go to Europe, they can afford to go to Orlando, and they can afford to go to Vegas, and they can afford to do a lot of things. All you got to do is buy a cheap plane ticket to Europe, and it's about the same cost in Europe as it is here. So, you know, for a lot of people, that's not an excuse. You're just afraid to deal with a foreign country. And I think getting out of your comfort zone is a beautiful thing. A lot of people are afraid of culture shock. Culture shock is considered a bad thing. No, culture shock, especially for Americans, is a beautiful thing. Culture shock is the growing pains of a broadening perspective. It's constructive. You need a guidebook or a tour guide like me to curate the culture shock, maybe. But my favorite thing is culture shock, and I want to learn more about my home and my lifestyle by leaving it and looking at it from a distance. I want to learn how other people do this, have the same struggles that we have, and I want to broaden my perspective. That's a beautiful thing. A lot of people are afraid to travel these days, and that just baffles me. I mean, when I started teaching, people said bon voyage. Nobody says bon voyage anymore. Now, what do they say? Have a safe trip. We'll pray for you. Well, come on. I mean, if somebody tells me have a safe trip when I'm going to Europe, I'm inclined to say, well, you have a safe stay at home, because where I'm going statistically, and I know statistics are optional these days, but where I'm going statistically is safer than where you're staying. And I just think the greatest thing we can do is travel. And if you travel well, you come home with that most beautiful souvenir, and that is with a passion for building not walls, but bridges, so you can connect with the rest of the world. The world's a beautiful place.
Well, I've been talking with travel host Rick Steves. You can hear Travel with Rick Steves every Sunday on WVXU at 3 p.m. Thank you so much for your time today, Rick.
Oh, so nice to be with you, and happy travels.
Happy travels to you. Up next, we'll get some holiday baking tips from local experts. This is Cincinnati Edition.